LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
The suggestion is that the function of the brain and nervous system and sense organs is in the main eliminative and not productive. Each person is at each moment capable of remembering all that has ever happened to him and of perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. The function of the brain and nervous system is to protect us from being overwhelmed and confused by shutting out most of what we should otherwise perceive or remember.
If there's an intelligence there, I wanted to know there's an intelligence here.
The Day of the Triffids.
Here's an image we all know well. It's an image which is in many ways a symbol of our times. It represents what is perhaps our greatest technological achievement so far, the step out into space. But the picture of our planet also has a far deeper significance. For the first time, we have seen ourselves and the planet from the outside. And the view has changed our feelings about ourselves in an unexpected way. For the early astronauts, the sight of the planet shining in the blackness of space was a profound experience. One of the astronauts who walked on the moon described his view of the Earth as an experience of instant global consciousness. He said, "When you're up there, you're no longer an American citizen or a Russian citizen. Suddenly, all those boundaries disappear. You are a planetary citizen." And similar experiences happened to the other astronauts. They saw Earth to be a beautiful, magical-looking planet and came back deeply changed from that experience. Moreover, they became increasingly aware that all was not well back on Earth, and they came back wanting to help in one way or another.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Stephen Buhner, who joins us to discuss his book, Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm, Beyond the Doors of Perception into the Dreaming of Earth. The book reveals that all life forms on Earth possess intelligence, language, a sense of I and not I, and the capacity to dream. It shows that by consciously opening the doors of perception, we can reconnect with the living intelligence in nature as kindred beings, once again become wild scientists, non-domesticated explorers of a Gaian world. Buhner explains how to use analogical thinking and imaginal perception to directly experience the inherent meanings that flow through the world, that are expressed in each living form that surrounds us, and to directly initiate communication in return. He delves deeply into the ecological function of invasive plants, bacterial resistance to antibiotics, psychotropic plants and fungi, and most importantly, the human species itself. He shows that human beings are not a plague on the planet. We have a specific ecological function as important to Gaia as that of plants and bacteria. Buhner shows that the capacity for depth, connection, and meaning-filled communication with the living world is inherent in every human being. It is as natural as breathing, as the beating of our own hearts, as our own desire for intimacy and love. We can change how we think, and in doing so, begin to address the difficulties of our times. Hello and welcome, Stephen, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks for having me.
Now, today, Stephen, we're going to talk about your latest book, which is just out. It's entitled Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm. Before we get into that, perhaps you'd like to tell listeners
a little bit about your background. And I thought, if you like, perhaps you could do that by talking about the early part of the book, because it's quite biographical and it really sets out where you're coming from and what aspects of your life that have set you on the path that you're actually on.
Well, like a lot of people, I'm 62 now, and I suppose from talking to my son and his friends, it seems that things haven't changed a lot. They've just changed to become like unique to our time. I was born pretty much into a dysfunctional family, like a lot of people are in both America and the UK, I think, and I didn't really fit into the boxes of life very well, and I had I was really close with my great-grandfather, especially, who was quite a wonderful man, and he was a physician that had trained in the early 1900s and began practicing in 1911, and he used mostly botanical medicines, and so I sort of was pulled into that older way of doing things where there weren't so many specialists. I think his medical training was 3 years long, and then he apprenticed for a year, and that sort of appealed to me, the concept of the citizen scientist or the amateur naturalist, or that sort of more hands-on dynamic. And as I went through schooling, I found that it just didn't really work for me. So I left home at 16 and began exploring on my own. I learned there was a difference between being schooled and being educated. And for whatever reason, I decided I wanted to become educated. So I made a list eventually, I think I was about 20, of all of the people I wanted to study with who had inspired me from their books or however they had done that. And I then spent the next 10 years going around studying with as many of them as I could. And so it led me into a very different direction than I think most people go. I was more interested in becoming a human being rather than a cog in somebody else's machine.
Well, one positive thing I would say is that some of the things you described there about your path, I think many more people are opting for those sort of options today. I think that's one of the positive signs for the future. One of the big aspects of your book is to do with mankind's perceptions of the world that we live in. When we're children, the barrier between the inner and the outer world hasn't really been erected in the way that it is in adults. That's something that gradually happens as we get older. And we become cut off from sensing the depth and the diversity and the wonder that's all around us. And it's, even most adults will be aware, you know, doesn't one cursory reading of the new physics will tell us that our brain takes in only a fraction of all the sensory information that we're bathed in constantly. But you point out how this perception or misperception perhaps is leading us, has led us down a very dark and dangerous path because we're misreading the nature of the world and indeed ourselves.
Well, I'm always looking for marvelous words or marvelous phrases to describe the invisibles of life. You know, we're trained from a very young age in the West to orient ourselves towards surfaces. And a marvelous phrase I found in the process of this particular book was from a German poet named Gottfried Benn, and it was the metaphysical background of the world. And he basically said, because we're so oriented toward surfaces, the metaphysical background of the world remains forever obscured to us. And the marvelous thing about children, and I remembered many of these experiences of my own, is that they aren't really oriented toward services in the same way we're trained in after, like, 14 years of school or whatever. To them, everything's alive, everything is ensouled. There's a huge wonder and tremendous excitement about things. They know plants have personalities, that they're intelligent and aware. And, you know, even it's odd that Western science, as it began to develop, really embraced that same awareness that children have and that all of us had at one time. And as time went on, it's like the most fundamental segment of Western science began to sort of take over everything and more and more orient everybody towards services. These are the people I now refer to as the reality police. You know, so because if you're going somewhere and you start talking and one of these people happens to be in the room with you and hears you, if you start talking about the intelligence of plants or that plants have personalities or feelings or that bacteria are intelligent, they always jump on any sort of a statement like that and reorient things back towards surfaces by saying, oh, you know, you're anthropomorphizing and you're projecting a human quality onto the world. But what's really true is that they're mechanomorphizing. They're projecting a mechanical nature on the world. And we've been so inculcated in that as the sort of the default foundational truth about the world and our relation to it that we've made so many decisions in the West, in science and in our cultures based on that sort of belief that it's just this sort of dead and sentient matter over there. And we stand over here, we're not really part of it. We can look at it and manipulate it how we want. And what we've been doing actually is destroying any possibility of sustainable habitation of the planet. I mean, the simplest one that I go into depth about in the book is by assuming bacteria were unintelligent and mere matter that we could manipulate the way we wanted through the creation of antibiotics, we've created this tremendously difficult problem where the bacterial researchers, the most eminent ones in the Western world, are now saying we've got maybe 20 years before we're going to see epidemics more virulent than human beings have ever experienced, because the bacteria are actually quite intelligent and they restructure themselves to avoid the antibiotics intelligently. So that my focus for the last 40 years or so has been to reclaim the feeling sense, the ability to touch the metaphysical background of the world, to basically that feeling sense that we have allows us to have empathy, to recognize intelligence, awareness, and soulfulness in the other living beings with which we inhabit this planet. And that's what I talk about as being one of the primary ways out. Really, the major act of revolution we can engage in is to reclaim our feeling sense.
Yeah, this comes up again and again through the book, doesn't it? You're asking us to ask, when we engage with the rest of creation, how objects, or even, you know, a sunset, a table, the sea, whatever it happens to be, how does this feel? And this sort of sixth sense that people talk about a lot, but of course it's been in our mechanistic sort of reductionist, certainly in the West anyway, culture, we're told to sort of dismiss this, even though people still actually rely on it more than they think. You know, sort of, I had a bad feeling about that guy, or, you know, the moment we met, it felt really good, that sort of thing. But we live in a sort of semantic world. Ever since language came along, that's been how we think literally in terms, you know, we consider a concept, we have words going through our heads, and it wasn't always that way.
Well, that thing about the denigration of the feeling sense, you know, by the reality police and everybody that they've managed to convert to their sort of orientation. You know, Alice Walker, the American poet, had a great little blurb she wrote out once in one of her books, and it was that the moment that an old granny in Alabama said that her greens didn't have a taste to them anymore, the whole country should have stopped, because how things taste is one of the major clues life gives us about our food. But the same thing is true about the feeling sense. It's astonishing to me how much people put up with because they've been so deeply trained to not trust their feeling sense. And so everybody continues to use it unconsciously, but they spend a lot of time in conflict with themselves, denigrating it in themselves as well. They've sort of absorbed that behavior. Other people did it to them, now they do it to themselves. But if people begin to ask themselves, like, You know, how does this hospital feel? You know, I don't know anybody that has ever gone into a hospital and says, you know, this place feels great. I would love to have a vacation here. I feel so rested. That's not how it feels. How does the pharmacy feel? How does the pills that you take, how do they feel? How does the place you work feel to you? Do you feel more happy in it? Does it feel, you know, expansive, life-affirming? We continually go through life immersed in very sophisticated fields of meaning, the metaphysical background of the world, and when we encounter various meanings, there's a feeling to them. And I'm not talking about emotions here. I'm talking about how something feels. Like you walk into a restaurant, like you were saying, you walk into a restaurant and you go, you know, this place feels funny. Let's go someplace else. Everybody has that, but that gives us extremely deep clues about the meanings that we're encountering as we move through the world. It's a primary part of evolutionary developed survival perception, and it can be raised to very sophisticated levels. But once we cut ourselves off from that, it's very difficult for us to do. It's much easier to be lied to, for instance, because you can tell somebody if they're lying, if a politician is lying, it feels funny in a particular kind of way. So that thing right there is one of the major errors that the Western world made when they cut that off from their awareness and as a normal part of life. And Gregory Bateson, who I admire tremendously, said that he believed that the loss of the aesthetic sense, the sense of aesthetic unity, was much more damaging of a behavior, of a choice for a culture than any of the minor insanities that had affected any previous culture that came before ours. And we've basically destabilized the entire natural world by doing that one thing.
Well, I tried a little experiment yesterday after completing your book, and I was in, I live in a city, so not in the countryside, and I decided to consider the environment and see how it felt. And to sum it up, I found that natural things, plants, birds, felt positive or at worst neutral if they'd perhaps been damaged in some way. And almost all of the man-made environment felt neutral to negative. And when it did feel vaguely positive, I noticed that it had some sort of artistic aspect to it. For example, an old building with carvings, you know, that some kind of creativity had gone into it. But none of the objects or buildings, like, you know, the modern bank building, which is just a box, glass and steel, it felt negative. And it was strange. I was surprised myself, to be quite honest with you, how powerful it was.
It's a very powerful thing to do, and when you start orienting yourself that way, because you start to perceive the meanings that are embedded in the form, in the thing itself. And Robert Bly, the American poet, said, you know, some things that I've found very useful over the years. One of them was, there was a time when every craftsman put eros and ethos into their work. In other words, they put love and care into the stuff that they made. So when you encounter something with that aesthetic sense in it, where the craftsman is shaping with their feeling sense involved in the process, a good craftsman feels deeply into the material that they're working with. They talk to it. They shape it with this kind of tender care, moving toward this form that somehow they've perceived in the depths of themselves that they want to bring into the world. But they don't force the material in a way into that shape. They urge it into being, and they, you know, as I think it was Michelangelo who said, I just chip away the parts that don't belong, you know, as if it was that easy. But there's something that it comes alive in a way, so that when we encounter it later, we feel that eros and ethos flowing from the thing itself into us. And that's you know, the root of the aesthetic sense. It's a breathing in of that kind of living, soulful thing from the world itself. Living organisms have it a great deal more, but nevertheless, human beings, when they were creating beauty in that way, it was a very deep focus for human beings for a very long time that when they created, that's what they would be doing. And you can see after World War II, it reached this point where postmodern architecture took over. In other words, glass and steel and box creation, and the massive Stalinesque buildings in Russia were like that, the ones in the United States, the ones in the UK. And somehow, right in that period, the Western world began to abandon the aesthetic sense and eros and ethos and work at a fantastic rate. And what we're left surrounded with now is basically this weird Euclidean world that has very little love in it, and just the most basic way of talking about it, very few craftsmen that build those kind of buildings have the time to love their work, and there's not a lot of aesthetic creativity that they're even allowed to do in the process. And as a result, we live embedded in this world that it's aesthetically impoverished to the greatest degree of any civilization in history.
When I was a child, I loved playing with Lego and decided that I wanted to become an architect. I never did, and I'm not consciously sure why, but I suspect it's because I thought that I'd end up being a draftsman, unless I was very lucky and discovered a great talent for the art. I'd end up basically working for a developer who was building little shoe boxes for people to live in. So I'll never know, of course, but I didn't follow that path. But this idea you talked about earlier, again, title of your book, Plant Intelligence, the idea of there being intelligence in plants and indeed everything to an extent. This is counterintuitive to some people because our common education, schooling, whatever you want to call it, tells us that the brain is the seat of intelligence and indeed consciousness, and therefore it's not possible for there to be intelligence in something like a tree. The idea is silly. But of course, this is not the case. And you actually point out very elegantly in the book so many of the commonalities between, say, plant life and animal life, human life. And then, and as you do, it becomes this idea of species being discrete begins to break down, and you really see one continuum of life.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you put that really well. We've been inculcated in this belief that, you know, we're on this planet, you know, a ball of resources hurtling around the sun, and there's a bunch of discrete, you know, organisms that just sort of emerged, you know, in the, you know, Darwinian struggle for survival and all of that stuff. And, you know, and one of them ended up really intelligent, and that was us, because, you know, we had opposable thumbs and, like, we were really smart and stuff. But what's really true is the Earth is this very complex, sophisticated, nonlinear, self-organized organism, and that every, which, you know, is embodied in James Lovelock's Gaia theory, that the Earth is a superorganism that self-regulates itself. Every life form that is generated out of that background matrix to fulfill ecological function, to help the self-organized entity of the planet remain intact. And Gaia continually innovates on how to do that better over a very long timeline. So when you start to understand that is at root what's true, not the old 19th century view that we've inherited, that it begins to make more sense. You begin to see what Gregory Bateson called meta patterns that flow through every life form. And one of those is the neural networks that form. So our picture of physiology and the way human beings are is real late 19th, early 20th century, and it's relatively useless. It came out of a lot of strange frameworks at the time that didn't have much to do with reality. But nevertheless, we're so inculcated in it, we we accept it without question, just like we used to accept, you know, 100 years ago without question that women, you know, were inferior to men, or people with black skins were inferior to people with white skins, and on and on. And what we've got is the same thing here. You know, plants are inferior to human beings because, you know, fill in whatever blank you want to fill in. The thing is that when they look at the brain is just an organ. It's not the thing itself. What the brain does is it holds a neural net inside of it. And that neural net, or the neural network, has a particular kind of shape and a particular way it functions. So if you look at a plant, I mean, you can tell the disrespect plants are held in by when they say, if somebody's in a coma, he's just a vegetable now. It's like, you know, it's like the ultimate dumbness, you know, that can possibly be attained to become a vegetable. But when you look at the plant root system, which is their brain, it looks virtually identical to the neural network that is in the organ that we call our brain. If you pull the neural network out, it will look virtually identical to that of a plant pulled out of the soil. The plant doesn't need an organ like we do because they're not mobile in the sense we are. They use the soil as the medium through which their neural network expands. And ours is limited by brain, our skull size. And so we're already at a disadvantage. Yeah, there's a lot of sophisticated stuff we can do. But the thing is, when you start really looking at the neural network of plants, you start to find out, like, some aspen trees in the United States cover several hundred acres and they're up to 100,000 years old. Their neural network completely dwarfs the human in size and sophistication and age. Plants have tremendous memory storage. They plan for the future based on current situations. They have a really sophisticated language. They caretake their young. I mean, it's the list goes on and on and on. And what we're really guilty of is a kind of a brain chauvinism, you know, just like, oh yeah, if he doesn't, you know, have a brain like us, you know, he's like, he's a vegetable. But it's just this weird, strange, inherited picture of the earth that we were given, and there's, you know, reasons for that picture. And James Hillman, who I have tremendous admiration for, he made a very poignant statement about that. He said it was only when science convinced us that the earth was dead that it could begin its autopsy in earnest. And that is the crux of Western technology and civilization. And it's a real problem because it's so inaccurate. And I also, one thing I bring up in the book that I think is completely hilarious is the person who first identified the plant brain and talked about it in detail was Charles Darwin. But, you know, that particular part of his work is continually overlooked. So, yeah, the world, you know, as Henry David Thoreau, the American poet, said, he said, you must understand that nothing is what you've taken it to be. And once you do that, you're really in a position that you can go into the world and find out for yourself what is true, which we really need to do. And one of the statements I continually have in the book is that one of Einstein's, where he says, we can't solve the problems facing us by using the same kind of thinking that created them. To really change everything, we have to go into the world and find out for ourselves what is true and genuinely begin to encounter the world in a very different way and have solutions come out of what really is there, not what we've been taught is there.
Yeah, this whole attitude that you refer to that shaped our society in the late 19th and throughout the 20th century, it's given rise to this human exceptionalism. Now, there's been, you know, that's been true to a degree down the ages, but particularly in the modern world, you know, but in the industrial age, we've had the wherewithal, the tools to do great damage coming from this mindset. Whereas even the Romans, for example, there was their empire was limited. It was limited to what damage they could do to the world around them. And this entire idea that we're above and beyond the rest of creation, not even taking into account the Christian idea, you know, that it's there for us to dominate and exploit. But even if you set that aside, that's what actually happens, this idea that we're separate from everything. And that can lead us, I think, into the madness that we're currently in, which is causing enormous damage and extinction left, right and center. But sort of kind of going ho-hum, shrug the shoulders, you know, what can we do? It's often like we're completely desensitized to it.
Yeah, we do. And the people that feel it, that the necessity to do something, the difficulty is the problem is so immense that they feel overwhelmed by it. They don't really know what to do. And, you know, so they end up sort of following this prearranged pattern of protesting or writing their, you know, representatives or their ministers of parliament, members of parliament, or whatever they're going to do. But nevertheless, there is this great genius inside human beings that if they really begin to directly encounter the world, and the world itself will begin to generate ideas in them about what to do that they've never had before. And the thing is, it's in each of us to focus sort of on the area that we have where our own particular genius comes to flower and do that. You know, the big picture is Gaia's problem. There isn't a human being alive that has the wisdom or the knowledge base to solve all of the problems in front of us. And that's part of the problem, is trying to get this sort of universal one-picture answer that's going to solve everything. You know, I think it's really hilarious that people continually talk about how, you know, intelligent the human species is compared to everything else. And I find myself more and more these days going, how many people have you met? I mean, you know, it's like, I've met a lot of them. And, you know, these are not like the brightest life form on the planet. They're not the sharpest knife in the drawer, you know. It's like to expect the mass of the human beings to be able to solve these problems, you know, in this sort of top-down, yeah, let's all do this and then we'll live forever and nothing bad will ever happen. It's not going to work. It is not the way it is. So, you know, you mentioned like the Romans, and they definitely had some serious problems. And you go back to any sort of large culture and you begin to find problems, whether it's ancient China or Egypt, or it doesn't matter. But the one thing, that was kind of the point Gregory Bateson was making, the one thing they all had that was different is that they had a fundamental belief in this aliveness that ran through everything. I mean, they had other crazinesses, but that one thing they did have. And we are really the first time in the history of human habitation of this planet, it's the first time that a culture has cut itself off from that awareness about the world. And the damage is so much more severe than anything that's gone before. It's a much more difficult problem to solve as well.
In Ridley Scott's film Aliens, one of the company men is talking to Ripley, the heroine, about how the humans are superior to the aliens. The aliens are just dumb creatures. And Ripley says to this guy, well, you don't see them fucking each other over for a percentage. And
yeah, they had some pretty good lines about that in there, I have to admit.
Yeah, but as you alluded to a moment ago, this idea of writing to your MP or your congressman, whatever it happens to be, this idea that we can fix some of the problems that we're facing in a top-down way is not really the path forward. And even organizations like World Wildlife Fund or Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth, whatever you look at, I've always been a bit skeptical about them. Because basically, well, they've all been around for decades and look where we are.
Yeah, the environmental movement, the way it was originally conceived, it had some early successes that were good, but eventually they just became part of the problem. They're large bureaucracies themselves that work with a lot of money, and they're constantly engaged in transactions with the rich and the powerful. And there's a fundamental belief they have, that many in government have, that individual human beings are actually like stupid children, and that we sort of all have to be managed by, you know, different laws and different groups of people, and, you know, for our own good, because we're too stupid to actually be in charge of anything anymore. You know, and the United States has always been, for a long time, much more of a Wild West place than the UK. But even here, it's starting to get, you know, it's many places illegal for someone to build their own home, you know, because you're considered too stupid to do that. We're prohibited from doing many things, and so there's this sort of infantilizing process that happens to the general mass of people because of the tremendous distrust that large organizations and governments have for individual citizens and their own ability to figure stuff out. But if you look at the areas, human beings are always trying to find ways out of that into unregulated places. And if you look at where they find a place like that and begin to really develop things, they come up with the most amazing stuff. I mean, permaculture came out of that. The modern herbal medicine movement came out of that. And one of the neat things I've seen in the UK and parts of Europe is because housing and land prices are so high, there's been that movement of people, especially in the UK, to move into forest areas and build these wattle and daub houses for like £1,000, you know, that are some of the most gorgeous aesthetic creations I've ever seen. I mean, they're just absolutely beautiful. And so all of this kind of interesting innovation has been occurring. And then, of course, when the authorities find out about it, they go, oh, we have to tear that down. You know, it's like, you didn't get the permits, and we don't like people living like that. But nevertheless, there's this sort of movement that's occurring of people solving problems in the most amazing way. And one of the main differences that I have is I trust individuals, the common people, to be able to find the solutions that need to be found in the location in which they live. You know, people are going to make mistakes, and mob rule is not exactly great either. There's problems with that. Nevertheless, the kind of problems you get inherent in entrenched bureaucracies don't occur. The problems you get from trusting the individual over time end up being less severe, I think, than entrenched bureaucracy. So, you know, I tried working in those arenas. A lot of people have, and you can't do a whole lot. And it's only really outside following what calls to you, your interest and your heart and your enthusiasm, that's where the solutions lie. And in a way, that's exactly the way the earth itself solves problems. It sends the impulse into the system. When the earth perceives a problem, it sends an impulse into the ecological systems of the earth, you know, in this sort of a burst of meaning that flows through the system. And the individual life forms and organisms, whether it's plants or whatever, they begin exploring solutions to that particular problem in their billions. And that's where innovation in Gaia comes from.
For all the benefits that it's brought us, our technology, I think, has contributed a great deal towards our disconnection from the natural world. In fact, a guest I had on here a few weeks ago, a chap called Giles Slade, has written a book on it called The Great Disconnect, or The Big Disconnect, can't quite remember. But I'm following along this route, and I mean, whatever the future holds, certainly technological innovation is happening apace. You know, you even got to look at the power of computers doubling every couple of years. But taking this to its illogical conclusion, as I see it, is that this transhumanist idea, you know, that we'll merge with machines and become virtually immortal and not be completely cut off from the natural world. I don't think this is going to turn out well. You know,
didn't they ever see the movie? No, it's not going to turn out well. But really, what that is, it's a utopian power fantasy, and part of it driven by fear of death, fear of powerlessness. It's this sort of dissociated utopian power fantasy because only people who don't understand the actual nature of life in this place could come up with that kind of idea. You have to be divorced from, you know, you have to literally experience yourself as consciousness harnessed to flesh, this rather unappealing body that you have to drag around from place to place. But consciousness is expressed out of the self-organization of the bodies that we have, irrespective of our particular genus or species. So the one thing that all of these people continually miss when they get into that ridiculous way of thinking is, you know, just have one of them create artificial spinach, okay, that is as good as real spinach, that you can actually eat, you know, artificial stuff like that. You can't do it. You know, you can fumble sort of toward things like that, but the earth has this capacity to generate life. That's one of the things I talk about in the book, is that, you know, a lot of reductionist researchers are now are saying things like, you know, the earth seems to have this eerie yearning for order, that it generates new life forms out of nothing, and it just, life comes into being without any predicate cause that we can find. And the thing is, everything we do is predicated on being able to pull material out of that self-organization or self-generating process. So all of our technology is based on, I mean, it's easy to say resource extraction, but what does really resource extraction mean? When we talk about it, most people think, oh, well, it's like, you know, iron ore or whatever, or coal or something. But what we're doing is we're pulling from this constantly regenerating pool of life, and then we cut it off from its source and transform it into other substances, which are now dead, that we can use in our technology. The problem is that self-generating pool of life that we are drawing on has become damaged beyond repair by what we're doing. Not beyond repair for the earth itself, beyond repair for us. We're basically, at this point, burning the house to keep warm in the winter. We have exceeded the carrying capacity of the earth. That's just true. Nobody wants to talk about it because, you know, the repercussions of that thought are just too grim. What's going to happen is eventually that whole system is going to break down, in the sense that we have a sort of ecological window that allows our species to really be the way that it is here, the temperature range, everything else. When that thing goes through a phase shift, which is what climate change really is all about, it's not so much the earth warming or whatever, it's that there's going to reach this tipping point where you're going to get a massive shift in the way the system appears. It's going to be like water turning into ice. There's people that had never seen ice before could never have predicted if you freeze water, it's going to turn into ice. It would be like magic to them. And it's going to be like that, this massive shift from one state to another. And the state we're in now allows us to inhabit the earth fairly benevolently in terms of the temperature and everything else. All of those projections about we're going to do, you know, go to Mars, or we're going to have this, or we're going to have that, or we're going to blend with machines, or there's going to reach a point where there is nothing else that they're going to be able to pull out of the planet, because the planet's just going to say, no, you can't, you're out of credit at the bank. And at that moment, without the ability for resource extraction like that, the whole technological gamble comes to an end. It's over. And in every area that I've looked, whether it's groundwater or topsoil or antibiotic resistance, it doesn't matter. We're reaching peak, not just peak oil, peak everything. Pretty much in terms of geologic time, we're reaching peak everything simultaneously. So If you truly inhabit your body, if you truly inhabit the earth, if you become an earth person, and you know you're part of a scenario here, surrounded by similar life forms, even though their bodies look different, that kind of talking that you're talking about, it's literally one of the most insane kind of commentaries I have ever heard in my life. It has so little to do with the reality of things. It's literally this dissociated insanity. But nevertheless, so many people think that it sounds reasonable. That just shows how far away we've gotten from reality here.
That concludes part one of our interview. Be sure to tune in next week for part two. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website, that's legalizefreedom.com, legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.